Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, our ongoing investigation into the cultures of consciousness. It is Burning Man week this week, and it's always a strange feeling to be in the Bay Area, not at Burning Man during Burning Man week. There's a kind of presence of absence, a sort of sucking sound of distant entertainment that kind of creates a sort of inverse layer in the city. But it's put me just thinking about the event and why I'm happy I'm not there and happy that it's still happening and very happy that I missed the rainstorm that closed the gates on Monday. That must have been a fun time. All those pent-up partiers heading down to Pyramid Lake and shocking the Native American neighbors with their antics. Not a scene I necessarily needed to see. But I have been thinking about Burning Man in terms of its origins, its development, where it's wound up, what aspects of it stayed true to its original sort of impulse, where it became something else. And it reminded me of one very significant turning point in my own experience going to Burning Man, which began in the early days of 1994. And while I did not go every year, I went most years until about 5 years ago. And, you know, I was there in the early 2000s. I was getting a little jaded, a little bored, because even if the specific material that one encounters, that particular art car, that particular costume, that particular, you know, shtick, is varied and often quite entertaining and at least absurd, the overall structure of the event codified and crystallized quite a long time ago. And if you're sort of familiar with all those dynamics, in particular if you had a sense of the festival before those crystallizations or earlier in the process, there's something a little deflating about recognizing that you're inside of kind of a structure that itself is not changing drastically and is also not very amenable to change, and that the kind of maker spirit that you see on display is constrained to be in certain zones, costume, music, performance, art car, theme camp, interactive event, which is plenty of wonderful things, but there's also a sense of a kind of ceiling on the whole experiment. So I was a little downtrodden with all that, and I realized that I had spent, even though I was a writer, I had spent most of my time at the Burn not writing. In fact, going out of my way not to write, not to take notes, not to even find out what was going on, not even to track down the movers and shakers and figure out who's who and what's what and sort of network the space. Far, that was the opposite of my intentions. But in 2003, I decided to do something that I do in other zones and have been doing for quite a long time, which is to give public talks. And it was sort of a very weird thing for me to do at Burning Man, because it's sort of the opposite of the spirit of Burning Man, at least the way that I interpret it, where I go to lose myself, be spontaneous, not reflect, not think, not use intellectual categories as much as possible, bounce around, be an idiot, be a kid, whatever, be a mystic. And so here I was bringing in my sort of cultural criticism self, and it was a little bit weird, but it turned out to be a remarkable, remarkable day. It was, for me, a wonderful talk experience. There was, I was doing it for the first year of Palenque Norte, which were these series of psychedelic oriented talks, and there were these great sort of weird little igloo huts that they were taking place in, quite small, but really wonderful kind of sci-fi vibe. And there was a dust storm in the middle of my talk, but people were all there. It was a very intense thing. But the other thing I did with that talk was that for the following year, actually that was 2002. For the following year, I turned it into a little pamphlet. And so I went to the Burn with these pamphlets of my talk about the Burn, and I kind of distributed them or traded them, and then I made them available on my website, but only for trade. Like I didn't ask for any cash. And I got all this wonderful stuff in the mail, and it really was remarkable, and this is a long way into talking about our guest today, that showed me how writing and printing and exchanging texts, that sort of zine model of cultural production, is not separate exactly from the sort of more festal, in-your-face, chaotic, expressive exuberance of a Burning Man kind of scene. In fact, they're deeply related, and in many ways that's one of the main topics we'll be talking about today, which is the relationship of the kind of zine world, this sub-commercial realm of the production and exchange of cultural documents, often quite intensely subcultural and hermetic, bizarre, even heretical in terms of political or sexual positions, and the relationship between the zine world and the broader counterculture, which I think is a fascinating and under-discussed topic, particularly now as we, I think, wrestle with some of the unpleasant consequences of the internet age, and many of us feel a kind of urge to make different kinds of cultural marks on the world than the pixels on a rectangular glowing screen. So to help us make this shift, or at least understand it a little better, today we're going to be talking with Christian Greer, a friend of mine, and also, like me, a PhD candidate in the booming, hugely important field of the history of esotericism. He's at the University of Amsterdam studying with Wouter Hanegraaff, who we had on the show before, but he's already been working in education. He founded a super cool project that we're definitely going to talk about called the Boston Corvid College, co-founded it, and has opened up other branches of this free university. There's a lot of free universities that are out there running, and I think it's a fascinating topic, and I want to hear about Corvid's particular twist. And currently, Christian is serving as a research fellow at the New York Public Library, looking through the materials of none other than Timothy Leary, which is, you know, kind of funny that you can get paid to go and read Timothy Leary's letters. So with no further ado, Maja will not be joining us today. I'd like to welcome Christian to the show. Hey, Christian, how you doing? Hello? Hello? We do not seem to have Christian speaking, so I will blather a bit more. What are we going to talk about? What are we going to talk about? I can talk more about Christian Greer. I think one of the first times I met him, he was doing an underground, like a little sneaky restaurant. And the whole mode of the sneaky restaurant is pretty good. You know, it's not accepted by the local food board. They're not doing the test. He describes it as an experiment in conviviality with gastronomy taking the place of pedagogy. And that was, it's a pretty good style. You know, we tend to underemphasize the glorious utopian and transformative possibilities of simple gatherings of friends. The dinner party, convivial gathering, I think, is under-remarked as a place to do cultural work, to do cultural politics, to resist and revise our views of the world. And the underground restaurant is a great form of it. So, Christian, I think we have you back.
Hey, what's going on?
Excellent, man. I was just talking about Undercover of Knife.
Where we met a few years ago.
Yeah, the old experiment. I like the line, the experiment in conviviality, and I was just talking about how with like that Hocking Bay idea where the form of the dinner party, the small gathering of friends, it's a very trivial thing in some ways, but it's also a very profound one that could we could squeeze more political and cultural life out of.
Oh. Absolutely. And I think it's important to remember two things in reference to Hakim Bey's work. The first is that the final part of Temporary Autonomous Zone was a appendix that quoted word for word Stephen Pearl Andrews of the Dinner Party, you know, a very famous American individualist anarchist, talking about the Dinner Party not as this sort of component of bourgeois life, but the Dinner Party as a social form, a convivial social form. And so, you know, you were talking about the restaurant. I said, yeah, I prefer to think about it as a social form with gastronomy and pleasure at the forefront. And, yeah, we'll talk about Corvid College later, but it's the same thing with that. I consider it not so much, you know, free school or experimental college. I prefer to think about it in terms of an experimental social form, a social form that sort of breaches the banal reality of consumerism or what is it, the commodified experience of eating, you know, like taking pictures of your food, you know, stuff like that, all the stuff that belongs to the sort of disgusting realm of, commodified existence.
Well, we could start, we even just, you know, dive in right here in terms of, in both those cases, you know, what one would more easily communicate as a dinner party or mm-hmm. a free university. Those are like categories we're familiar with. And what you're suggesting is that behind the surface of that, there's something that may look very similar to those things, but is actually perhaps more productively or creatively thought as experiments in social experience. And what's funny is that we don't have a place in our minds for that idea, for the social experiment always has to be in another category. Oh, it's a party. Oh, it's a theater. Oh, it's a picnic. Oh, it's a university. And by always putting it into those categories, we completely forget, and I think that people generally completely ignore the way in which all of these more or less informal gatherings of people have a lot of creative and unexpected possibilities in them. And instead, we find ourselves going through these sort of routines based on the templates of dinner parties.
I mean, I think that so often these templates, that's a perfect word for it, act as frames. And those frames can be beneficial. There's no doubt about it. But it's also very important to keep in mind that within those frames, people come to assume identities. And, you know, so for example, at Corvid College, really one of the most prohibitive identities you can occupy is student. You're already talking about an asymmetry there. And that asymmetry isn't beneficial necessarily. And in fact, most of the time it's unhelpful. With the dinner party, that's a pretty good one because, of course, you have host and guest, and I do enjoy inhabiting the role of host because it allows for hospitality. And I consider hospitality a spiritual virtue. I'm not really associated with any religious movement or anything like that, but, you know, I consider friendship, conviviality, joy, sharing, all of these being, of course, anarchist things that the anarchist tradition really tends to celebrate. I consider all of these essentially spiritual aspects. But one thing to mention, and I have a question for you, Eric, is why is it, and this was the question that was really on my mind, as well as my partner, Michelle Owing, when we founded Undercover of Nights, which was this sort of underground restaurant dinner party, was why do people take photos of their food? Like, what is produced when you take a photo of your food? Any ideas about that? I mean, have you mused about that before?
I've mused about it because I have a strong reaction to it, and so as I do...
That tends to be the inspiration.
What's that?
And that tends to be the inspiration for most of my musing as well.
Yeah, I have a strong reaction to it, and, you know, so it almost instantly goes into a larger category, which are my strong reactions to a lot of contemporary hyper-mediated culture, particularly around devices. I still don't own a smartphone, and I'm a little bit of a lab rat at this point. I'm kind of the control group of a lot of these things that's happening. So I have a weird angle because I sort of inherently I'm not drawn into that world. So I was kind of wondering, like, well, it's like, you know, where are things that I think are truly wrong, and where are things that are just bizarre? Like, what do I know? And the taking a picture of the food, it's weird because, I mean, food is so over fetishized in our culture. And here's actually, let's just talk right about food, because that's a great example of The consumption of food is one of the most reliable sources of pleasure in our daily lives. It is also one of the most reliable sources of conviviality, even if we're just living with a couple or a small number of people in a home, or we go out to a restaurant, you know. Yeah, people eat alone, but a lot of times people eat together. Even in restaurants, they'll talk to each other or cafes or whatever. So it's like a very reliable place to get some of the best stuff in life. Feeling good, good sensory experiences, and social communication. And yet, so one would presume that all of this attention on foodiness that has now, you know, taken over the West, from hipsters to highbrows to CEOs, whatever. Everybody loves food. Everybody loves restaurant. Everybody loves local. Everybody loves carefully constructed recipes, yet all of that attention has sort of missed precisely the engagement with pleasure and the engagement with others. And so when I'm at the few times that I've been at a table where people pull out the phone and take pictures of the food, I'm offended. Because it pops me out of the space of possibility that I bring and open to the unique zone of eating dinner with somebody. And instead, it creates another circuit which loops it through this fetishized world of, like, I mean, what's more, like, pornographic in a way than a picture of food? Because it's like, it's so much taste, so much presence, but you're not going to taste, you're not going to smell, you're not really present. And so I find it very unnerving, frankly.
It certainly is. I mean, the term I like to use is existential displacement. You know, it takes you one dimension back, and it doesn't completely drain the event. The convivial event, you know, you'll still taste the sorbet, you'll still be able to enjoy the gin and tonic. But, you know, my take on this is that I try to be sympathetic. You know, what is that motivation? And how am I sympathetic to the person who does it? And I've come to the conclusion that the image of it to share with one's so-called social media friends, and oneself, the image has come to become is more important than the actual event. No, it is more valuable for me to look at this while I'm at work on my Facebook. It is more valuable to me to have this digitally mediated to myself than it is for me to feel the pleasure of it right now. And this is very much like a 90s idea of, you know, the simulacra. But, I mean, to me, this is just, as you said, pornographic evidence that, you know, we live in the age of total mediation. And I think that might be the circle, you know, almost coming complete, you know, is that the images of these things, the images of our pleasure, for example, the tourist who goes on the trip and just takes photos, you know, they don't admire the canals in Amsterdam. They take a photo and they keep moving. You know, it's almost predatory. Get the photos, prove to the people you did it, and then somehow if you clicked off all the boxes on the checklist of Amsterdam, you've gained that experience, you've gained that badge without ever setting foot in that psychogeographic terrain.
Yeah, it's funny. It's always hard when I get in these conversations because I hear in my own voice the sort of, potential to be, I don't want to say reactionary, but to be sort of authentical. You know, like, this is no longer authentic. People are drawn away from the thing. And, I was schooled with enough postmodernism to be skeptical of some easy distinction between presence, authenticity, actual experience, and this realm of mediation. And so I believe that it's not as black and white in that. But what I don't think is people are aware of is how, despite that, if you want to just think of it in terms of circuits, there's a certain circuit that is produced with five people around a table with no electronic mediation. And if you introduce even one person starting to text somebody, you break that circuit. You have opened up another circuit. Now, that may be fun. It may be part of your celebration. Perhaps your food is being uploaded to some crazy, you know, system that's recreating different kinds of recipes based on the images. You know, some, like, interesting experiment, blah, blah, blah. Gross. I don't want to shut that down. I don't want to be sympathetic you. But at the same time, there's just this lack of awareness about how humans shift between different levels of scale, different bubbles of intimacy and exposure, and that the whole art of moving through these different realms is itself an art of survival, an art of politics, an art of culture that needs to be cultivated in itself.
Yeah. I mean, but of course, the perfect crystallization of this is what Burroughs called the third mind. You know, when Brian Geisen and he were experimenting with writing techniques, they believed that when they were together writing, collaborating, that it wasn't Burroughs and Geisen doing the work. It was this collective mind that they were summoning that was then they were channeling. And you find this in the New Testament as well. You know, when two gather in my name, you have the Holy Spirit. You can also find it, or Hermes, is the god of messengers. You know, and he accompanies messages, intimate messages, heart to heart. But yeah, I mean, I think that you're right on with that point. Another thing I like to mention in regards to taking cell phone pictures of everything is that I grew up before cell phones became totally ubiquitous, and this is going to sound like a real sort of old fart thing to say, but the parties were more fun because you weren't worrying about video surveillance. You know, video surveillance or someone having a camera phone puts a artificial ceiling on what can go down at that party. You know, because everything that you do, you'll have to account for it in the sober light of day. You know, so I guess that's why we didn't allow cell phones. That was one of the reasons we didn't allow cell phones at Undercover of Night, because we were stressing the social, the experimental social form of conviviality and eating than the restaurant experience.
Yeah, let's stay with that, because I think that's a really beautiful and kind of inarguable idea. Like, even your most positive proponent of taking photos all the time and sharing them with everybody will recognize that that's the case, that it puts a ceiling, particularly on more absurd, hedonic, of-the-moment kinds of experiences, experiments, encounters in the context of a party. Now, what it suggests to me, and this is an interesting thing, is that it has to do, again, with this moving between different worlds that have different circuits or different kinds of bubbles in them, in that what the technology, media technology, is so arrogant and so demanding and so so seeking ubiquity that people begin to feel like if you show up at a party and go, hey, could you just throw – here, we're going to keep all the cell phones in this room, close the door. You can get it at the end of the night. That a lot of people would find that to be an affront. A lot of people would be threatened by that. A lot of people would be angry by that, at least mm-hmm. irritated by that claim.
Mm-hmm.
And what that suggests to me is that people are losing the capacity to recognize, and maybe this is partly just the way that postmodernity works, is that the different spheres of life that used to be more clearly demarcated from one another are now all blending. So, you know, when I go to the school, I'm a school guy, and then I go to the cafe, and I'm the cafe guy, and then I go to a crazy party, and that's a different space that has different kinds of rules. And now, increasingly, all these worlds are kind of blending and linking in this sort of array of disciplinary mechanisms, self-disciplinary mechanisms, and particular mediation and capture. I want to get back to your story a little bit, because I love your own course into this stuff. You know, what was it in your own experience or your own thinking that first brought you to appreciate and begin to be concerned with the construction, development, and experimentation with these special spaces of conviviality, of an anarchist alternative to consumerized experience?
Of course, that the anarchist tradition is replete with examples of what I consider to be noble qualities, you know, sharing, collaboration, non-hierarchical. But, I mean, I don't want to categorize all of these things as just anarchists, because I think you can find them in a number of traditions. But what got me into it? I mean, I haven't really narrativized my life before. You know, I don't write prose so much, so I'm not really sure what got me into it. I mean, I like to think that it was just experience with family and friends, that just once the computer technology was introduced into that, I guess I'm more focused on, you know, contemporary moments where I do feel allergic to the total integration of technology into, yeah, I like how you said, different spheres of life. But, I mean, instead of being uptight about it, I tried to understand it from a historical perspective, which would be, I guess what we see before us now is the evidence of the seamless integration of technological communication. And so it's like, you know, people get all uptight when you try to take away their cell phones at the dinner table. To me, that might be considered rude, but in another way, it is evidence that these technologies have been integrated as though they were a prosthetic, as though they were a part of the person's body. And this is like saying, give me your eyes tonight, or, you know, please leave your sense of smell in the other room. I mean, that's really the type of reaction you seem to be getting. And I guess what makes me so kind of miffed about the whole thing, and it's the same with Facebook and that technological integration in everyday life, is that no one prepared me for it. You know, no science fiction ever came out and said, you will willingly give your personal life to the machine. You know, all of it was going to be Big Brother prying into your house, or it was going to be mind lasers that read your thoughts. You know, it was always going to be an invasive technology that ended up destroying the social. You know, it was always going to be some alien or authoritarian force that dominated humanity and that completely, you know, crushed whatever squishy, weird, you know, the moisture of friendship, you know, that very precious thing that makes a good dinner party a good dinner party. You know, no, you know, Philip K. Dick didn't get it, Wells didn't get it, you know, none of my favorite sci-fi writers came to this conclusion. And so I guess that's why I feel so miffed about the whole thing, is I wasn't prepared for everyone. I mean, this is like a CIA fantasy that we would upload all of our most precious moments and insights and ideas on a central mainframe.
No, yeah, I mean, it's incredible, too, because I even sort of feel this weird, how to say it? It's like this, like I'm alienated from parts of my own desire and my own fantasy in ways that I never would have expected, because I don't participate personally in too much of this. So I'm, even though I'm public, I do this podcast, I do talks, I write books, I'm not that like super mediated. So I feel like I still have some shred of a private life. But even inside that shred, you know, searching anything that involves information, anything that involves the internet, I find myself like pursuing some, you know, strange corridor of conspiracy theory or a place that I'd like to travel, you know, and then the ads follow me through my networking. It's like I have my own desire concretized and fed back to me as some kind of consumer opportunity. And so I've developed an increasingly just alienated relationship even to my own fantasy, my own dreams, my own desires, as if they're already kind of part of a larger circuit. So let's ask the difficult question, recognizing the very important point that you made, that science fiction did not prepare us for this, that futurism did not prepare us for this. This was an unexpected move. People were not looking forward to this in any kind of way. But it has something to do with the counterculture. It has something to do, there's some mode of mediating, enjoying, expressing, you know, there's this utopian element that led to the situation. It's very complicated. I'd love to hear you riff on that.
Well, I think it's a matter of everyone becomes the star for 15 minutes. You know, if we're creating, this is like the discourse. This isn't me talking. This is my parody of the discourse, is that, you know, you don't need TV. You can be your own television star, you know. You don't need pornography. You can film your own erotic cinema at home. You don't have to worry about celebrities because you are one. The problem with that, of course, is that it drags your identity to this image of the celebrity. It doesn't bring celebrities to you. You know, so what that means is you're going to start commodifying yourself in this prefabricated mode, which is the celebrity culture. And so you're going to start taking photos that perhaps mimic the postures of celebrities. You're going to style yourself as though you deserve to be treated like a celebrity, instead of, you know, what I would hope would be a reaction against this, which would be equality, you know, making everyone on equal footing in terms of creating enjoyable media.
Right.
But I think this was the main thing. I mean, the counterculture was about doing your own thing. It was about celebrating diversity and access to tools, you know, that famous tagline from the Whole Earth Catalog. And that's really what technology has given us. But, you know, it's like this old thing. You have to be careful that you're using the tools and the tools aren't using you.
So how do you do that in your own, some of your own, you can talk about Corbett, you can talk about other experiences. I'm curious how you explore as well as try to understand that edge in our current moment.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I'm a firm believer in the line, you attract more bees with honey than vinegar. And so let's just say that I dedicate my life to experimental social forms, whether that's in the form of a college, which is Corbett College, or a restaurant, which is Undercover Knife, or this kind of private society. I'm doing like a private teaching society now called the Order of St. George's Horse. Regardless of the social form, I'm really trying to reinvest and get others to reinvest with me in each other's creative imaginations, in each other's ability to entertain and to inspire one another without recourse to technology, without recourse to the prefabricated desires that have been commodified for us. So, for example, in a class that I'm teaching, I'm about to teach in September, I'm opening a branch of Corvid in New York City in September, and it's on J.D. Salinger's glass family and the metaphysical preoccupations they have. So what I mean by reinvesting people in their own curiosity and their own imagination is sitting down for 4 hours around the table, you know, maybe some food, some nice wine, maybe some beer, spirits, or what have you, and just enjoying each other's company with the cell phones in the other room. I mean, that's the only thing I ask, is that we keep the cell phones in the other room and just have 4 hours with each other. And very slowly, it has a very cool effect, which is that's a very minimum thing to ask. But you realize that it becomes a major social absence. And then I think there's a little bit of uneasiness with the absence of this technological aesthetic. And I think that in that absence, you begin to build a muscle. You know, I like to think of the imagination as a muscle. And at first, you sit around people and they'll get bored or they'll get cranky or unimaginative or whatever. And I think that's like trying to lift a weight that might be a little bit too heavy. So maybe you need the person to the right to kind of help you lift it with you, or perhaps I can help you lift it, or, you know, whatever. But I think that collaboration is the ultimate aid when it comes to building the imagination like this. And so, I mean, the benefit of this is it's highly enjoyable to be with other people who have the same curiosities as you and look you eye to eye and talk heart to heart and cultivate, you know, these really far-out ideas or these things that make you really excited and really set your imagination and thinking aflame.
This is wonderful. It's brought up a lot of questions, but we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking with Christian Greer, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Check out the archives for tons of earlier conversations. Let's stay on this topic of conversation. That actually comes up a lot on this show because while it is sort of in the interview format, I really think about this show as a model of conversation, and even though we don't have call-in people for technical reasons more than anything, there's definitely a gesture towards the art of conversation, which for me is also one of the things that is threatened by some current developments, not just in terms of the distraction of technology or what or the changes that happen when conversation is mediated through asynchronous forms or through, you know, web forms or just even text, that there are other ways in which I think conversation is threatened. And part of it is the sort of willingness to know and not know at the same time. For example, the classic event when you're arguing with someone about some point of fact, and there's the impulse to Google it. Now, I mean, I'm not making a hard and fast line there, one way or the other. I've done that. I mostly resist it. I mostly am happy to not do it. But sometimes it seems appropriate, and it's part of the fun no problem. It's not like a black and white situation. But there is some way in which I think that people's capacity to indulge their speculative imaginations in the sort of late night wine and cannabis mode really actually does a disservice to people's capacity to connect with their own creativity. And I think that that is harder to do for a lot of people because we're so, and I'm talking about me here, where I'm so aware of all of the discourses that are going on, everything that you can imagine. There's a whole world online of people talking about it and all these experts, and there's so much ego and communication, so much confidence or fake confidence or bullshitting that go on in the way people present, that it creates a very toxic environment that's hard to develop that kind of speculative richness, which is, I think, part of what you're gesturing to with this idea of gathering people together with the goal of releasing and developing collective creative imagination.
Oh, definitely. And I think that to that point, two things come to mind. The first is that when you're having these late night conversations, I really do feel as though there's a momentum, a sort of excitation, a spontaneous desiring, co-desiring that happens. And like with this momentum, you could sort of spin, and you could really reach the most cosmic heights in conversations that go far into the morning. Whereas if you bring a piece of technology into it, there is this, I don't know, it seems to bring people right down to earth, and not in a good way. It seems to eject them from that momentum, and I think it really falls apart. I'm not a huge, and plus, I mean, coming from someone who's done a lot of academic research, or some academic research, the information on the Internet isn't reliable. I mean, especially if you're looking at Wikipedia. I mean, I was telling you this last time we were hanging out, but it's like, you know, if I really have something I really want to get into, I don't Google it. I use JSTOR. Yeah. You know, I just, even like factual things, like what year was Discordianism founded? Well, if you Google it, it's going to say 1957. If you click around, it's going to say 58. It's going to say 59. But, you know, if someone wants to solve a bet, they're going to say, oh, that's 1957. I told you, and here's the Wikipedia link. It's like, well, you know, as someone who looks at Discordianism, that's not exactly true, you know, in a sort of empirical way.
Yeah, it's. I think anyone who knows, who's looked at Wikipedia pages on material that they know about, is sometimes shocked by the errors. But also shocked, and this is a hobby horse I've ridden before on this show. So, for those listeners out there, I apologize for repeating myself, but it's incredibly aggravating to see the smeary, obvious thumbprints of the skeptical atheist brigade smeared all over Wikipedia entries on anything to do with the paranormal, parapsychology. It's pathetic. It's so obvious. And the fact that they don't see how obvious this is an indicative of, one, how benighted many of those people are, but more disturbingly, how much sort of mainstream discourse in general is actually being well constrained in terms of thinking certain ways on from perspectives that are basically untrue. I mean, it's just, there's just a lot, oh, that's just not true. Oh, no, that's just not true. Yes, I've done the research. That's just not true. And it's a very weird, slippery feeling, you know, to think, to want historical information, particularly to want factual information in order to organize your worldview in this current moment. It's a very confusing thing to do.
Even personal information. So, for example, Corbett College had a Wikipedia page that I've been trying to either alter or take down, just because the information isn't up to date and it's not exactly right. But you know, Wikipedia builds itself as like open source. You know, you can really make any changes you want, and you can. I mean, it's really controlled, it seems, by a probably large group of individuals that have taken it upon themselves to be the sort of custodians of what is true and what is not true on Wikipedia. And this became particularly frustrating when I was working on deep ecology. And, I have a chapter in Egil Asperger's Contemporary Esotericism about defining deep ecology. And so I put in a lot of time and effort into the different and competing notions of deep ecology. Well, you go on Wikipedia, and it's going to give you What do they say? 10 pounds of ice cream and 10 pounds of shit gives you 20 pounds of shit. That's what you have there. And so, yeah, it's particularly frustrating to think that this is now the benchmark of, you know, data that we can quote to each other. It just isn't. I mean, here's a question for you, Eric. Remember when the Internet wasn't so boring?
Oh, I do. No, let's talk about that. I mean, you're doing some of your own your PhD research on earlier phases of let's call it, you know, internet culture or online computer culture that were far more ferociously weird, celebratory, and unpredictable.
Oh, utopian. I mean, if you look at, for example, some of the early stuff on cyberculture, you know, we're talking about like Gibson, Sterling, like sort of the early Mirror Shades group. I mean, those guys were just letting it rip with technological utopianism. And then you had Extropian follow right behind them, you know, immortality pills, downloading your brain to consciousness, AIs achieving omniscience. I mean, really quite exciting stuff. And I mean, the Internet as a possible weapon to bring down nation states and, you know, all of these things. It was really an exciting time, it seems. And the connection to psychedelic consciousness was front and center in magazines like Mondo 2000, Reality Hackers, those sort of things. And, you know, so I really enjoy researching the cyberpunk moment for a few reasons. Not only do they have pretty exciting characters and gadgets and an interesting take on noir, but it really was this open moment where it seemed as though a dimension had been imagined and created that did pose a threat to conventional reality and the technological infrastructure that the culture industry uses to create it.
Well, let's push back on that a little bit in the sense that, you know, if I think about today, a lot of the Extropian ideas are, of course, alive and well and kicking in Singularity University inside the halls of Google and Facebook. I mean, there's a lot of very serious post-human thinking now in sort of inside some of the main corporate drivers of the Internet. And that makes me also kind of remember that, like, while there were these at least very mind-expanding moments and spaces and some zones of utopian reorganization within cyberpunk, there's, of course, also a lot of sort of cynicism about politics and the street and crime and that kind of gritty noir effect. So it seems to me that that all of these technological moments also, they combine these sort of dark dystopian possibilities with these utopian spaces. And that we're sort of still doing that. I mean, there still is this kind of utopian trace or gesture within some transhumanist ideas, even though the forms that it takes, at least in my opinion, are for the most part not as you know, creative and liberating as they could be. Like, how do you think about that today? How do you think about the way in which the Extropian ideas, which were such an important part of that cyberpunk, early cyberpunk moment, how they've manifested today as a kind of symptom of how things have changed?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, they've manifested, but I think the appropriate word here is they've been co-opted. You know, they've been totally appropriated by the tech industry, which, of course, is beholden to the governments around the world, particularly the U.S. government. But, I mean, it's important to keep in mind that these ideas are 30 years old. And so, you know, in the 1980s, this was the cutting edge, the next edge of utopian thinking, Gnostic ideation, stuff like that. But now I'm left to think, what happened? I mean, I saw how it was appropriated by the forces of capital, but, you know, where are the hacker phones? You know, why isn't there a satellite in orbit that anarchists use, for example, that's totally encrypted, that's easy to get? You know, I think we were talking about this the last time, but just minor digital defense stuff. For example, like a sunscreen, this is just an idea I had that I thought was kind of cool, just like a sunscreen you put on, like SPF 5, and you put it on in the morning, and it blurs your face on all digital recording technologies. You know, or where are these just, like, exciting homemade cyberpunk hacks that this technology was all sort of forecasting? You know, it wasn't forecasting total surveillance with Google goggles. You know, it wasn't forecasting Facebook and the banalities of a contemporary post-capital world. I mean, it was the sort of the street finds its own uses for things, and I'm wondering where the street is these days. I mean, how about a little switch that you can tap that blinks out all hard drives in a 2-meter radius? You know, just like these really pernicious digital defense devices. I mean, I haven't seen anything like that.
No, I know. I have a friend of mine who I mean, I'm probably okay. Maybe someone will produce the idea. And he came up with this really, you know, there's a whole issue around cell phones being able to be remotely activated and turning them into recording devices. And it turns out that it's basically impossible to turn off your phone. Like when you think you're turning it off, you're really only putting it on standby. And that those things can themselves be modified, you know, in real time for surveillance purposes. And so there's different strategies people have come up with when they have meetings where they don't want to be recorded. You know, if you put everything in the freezer, that's usually pretty good, blah, blah, blah. But my friend was like, why don't they just make a phone where there's a mechanical way to interrupt the power source from the rest of the phone? So you physically remove something that makes it impossible to draw any power at all. And I'm like, yeah, this is another example. Like, why isn't there this sense of sort of the need to reassert control? It's that bubble thing again, of being able to build a bubble just for now, to here in this room where we're in a bubble. We can just do whatever we want here. You know, what we do is secret.
Science fiction did give us that. That's in Frank Herbert's Dune. You have these cones of silence. Do you remember that?
It's oh, yeah.
A really cool moment. Yeah. But so you can just dig through, you know, sci-fi and find a lot of the digital defense. I mean, if technology has become a prosthetic, then we need some prosthetic self-defense stuff, you know. Just, like, you know, maybe this would be cool if you took it in a furry direction, you know, like skunks have this spray that they smell. So, you know, maybe some type of digital bit or bite spray that, you know, totally snow crashes all the devices around you or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, let's get to this question. It's a tough one. Where is the street today? Like, where is this happening? Because I think people grow up, especially young people, they're growing up in a world that's always already networked, always already mediated, tracked, you know, da da da. And I don't even know where you would go other than into the deep recesses of your own mind to have some sense of a kind of unmarked space, maybe even the possibility of thinking of an outside or a beyond or an other space is sort of precluded by the conditions that we live in now. And that's a terrifying thought. But I sometimes wonder, I'm just sort of asking the same question in other terms now. I sometimes ask myself whether my sense of what's being lost is just a romantic residue of the idea that there's something outside, something beyond reason, something beyond civilization that's incredibly important to connect with, at least on occasion. And that whole model, that whole idea, is kind of an old school romantic construction that is really just no longer appropriate for the situation we're in. And I wrestle over that, and I'm sure you have your version of it as well.
No doubt, man. Hey, I'm wondering how much time we have, because there's actually a point. I mean, there's a few things I'd like to talk to you about, not just we'll say underground lit and zines and stuff, and that the connection to pirate radio there. But also, this is just a sort of weird idea that you mind if I throw this at you?
No, we got about 10 minutes, so go.
Oh, cool. All right, so I was thinking about this a couple days ago when I was listening to Terrence McKenna. The sort of implicit hierarchy of psychotropic altered states of consciousness. And Terrence McKenna lays it out really clearly. You know, he says, first, on the bottom rung, he's not interested in it. It's meditative state. Second is cannabis. Above that is LSD, and then psilocybin, and then DMT. You could put ayahuasca in this. But, you know, the implicit hierarchy of profundity for these things. And I was thinking, and in my writing, I'm working this point out, that what happens if we don't buy into that construction? You know, what if we look at each? So, for example, some groups I look at have an affinity for cannabis, whereas others LSD. And what if you consider each of those psychoactive substances as a discrete conversation partner? almost as an entity, and that to put them in a sort of pantheon does a disservice, or it's just, I guess, insulting to the inner empiricism of one state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Have you thought about this?
No, I mean, I kind of remember Terence doing, in general, I think of him as someone who's not too... hierarchical in his judgments. Although in some ways that makes sense that he would make that line. Although I think personally cannabis is more important to him than anything. But
maybe most people. That's in the world and it's double.
Agree with what you're saying. To two points that I'm firmly. I think it's incredibly valuable to intelligently. With some degree of supernaturalism, but really more intelligently approach the relational way of dealing, particularly with psychoactives, but also with foods and other things, where there's some kind of there's a sense of a personality of some kind of interaction through the experience, and that in, more to the point, though, I think part of your question is realizing that there's not a hierarchy, and the most extreme ones definitely don't necessarily have that much to say for a lot of the other reasons that you might go to a psychotropic experience, that there's a whole realm of what I call subtle allies, which have the quality of the ally that people associate in the counterculture with the big guns, with psilocybin, with ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. Here we are in the shamanic realm where there's allies and we're having some kind of conversation. Yeah, but tea is an ally, particularly when you construct the theater of the convivial space. I mean, tea is a great example of, in the right context, performed with the right art, tea can be a mind-blowing experience, you know, almost telepathic, almost MDMA-like in its empathic powers, in the right situation and the right kind of tea. So that's a space that I also feel that we really have there's a big zone that people have already existing in their lives where they can bring attention and bring a sort of willingness to experiment and to create conviviality even with non-human exchanges as a way of exploring and reclaiming some of this larger space of collective creativity that you're talking about, that it very much involves bringing in even the most modest psychotropics into a conversation.
Oh, yeah. I dig it. Well, hey, this other thing I wanted to talk to you about was Discordianism, because you and I have had conversations between ourselves about it, but I don't think we've ever had a public conversation. And I seem to have missed every paper you've given on Wilson. And maybe it's been vice versa. I did a paper not too long ago called Anarchist Esotericism, the Anarchist Esotericism of Peter Lamborn Wilson and the Esoteric Anarchism Robert Anton Wilson. Anyways, I just wanted to throw a couple ideas by you about how I'm looking at Discordianism these days and get your response to them.
Absolutely.
The first is, I haven't seen an author yet analyze Discordianism. I mean, you see a lot of people talking about it as a parody religion, a joke religion, some type of lugubrium. I like to think of it as a lugubrium. I've said that somewhere else, but I think the most important way to look at its use of paradox and its use of humor is as a liturgical language. You know, I've always...
What's a liturgical what?
A liturgical language.
Oh, okay.
So this is something I use in my review of Carol Cusack's book, Invented Religion, and I try to make a point of it that, you know, it's not about, you know, it's this religion that uses jokes, and wow, that's like a very funny thing, but there's a serious core. Now, I don't like that at all. I mean, I think that there is, what do they say, like, serious and sober aren't the same. You know, serious and sober are not synonyms. So you could be serious in this liturgical language and still produce, I think, transcendental and have transcendental aims with humor, with paradox.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's there's a number of things to say about that. We do only have a few minutes left, but we're going to I'll cram it in. One, just to bring it around to the topic at the beginning of this show, I was talking about this article I wrote on the cults of Burning Man, which was a way of looking at Burning Man phenomena through these different kind of groups, the cult of experience, the cult of flicker, and one of this was the cult of chaos, by which I meant a kind of sacred irony. And the whole category of sacred irony, which you can trace through historical religions, you can find it in Taoism, you can find it in Zen, you can find it, you know, even in Christian saints, you can find elements of it where the basic gesture of irony, where something is presented as authentic, as valuable, as meaningful, as sober, as, you know, the foundational, is then sort of undermined, but undermined in a way not simply to be satirical or to be critical, but to almost like leave the space open that's left after it's been undermined as another site of the sacred. And this, you know, obviously humor is incredibly important, but with the Discordians, oh, yeah. You know, you can go back, and I got to hand it to her. I mean, I hadn't read this in a long time, but I went back and I looked at Margot Adler's, you know, yep. account of paganism, and in the 70s, she already pegs it. She sees yep. that Discordianism is a religion of parody and humor, and, oh, yeah. you know, it's deeper than that. There's other things to say about it that she doesn't talk about, but I was really pretty impressed when I went back and reread that about how, from the pagan point of view, you know, from the contemporary neo-pagan point of view, it's very clear the way in which Discordianism and subgenius are quote-unquote real religions, whereas I think religious scholars have a much more difficult time dealing with that because they don't really know, they don't see the connection between satire and spirituality, which is a very psychedelic mode as well, very psychedelic.
The thing is, they've really weaponized humor. So, you know, Discordianism at its basis is a religion based on widening consciousness. This is why the tagline is, I've seen the snores, as opposed to the Church of the Subgenius, whose motto is, give me slack. You know, there's a difference there. And Discordianism has always been a singular religion, an individual religion based on expanding consciousness. And when you do a hoax, that is a weapon against what you consider to be a malign form of consciousness. It's a way to shatter that dogmatic belief in conventional reality. So, you know, humor is used as a weapon in a sort of culture war that I don't think many other, we'll say, ideas or traditions have done before. So this is why I think there's a little bit of confusion around it.
Yeah, that's. I think you're totally right. And that is a topic for another show because we're going to have to wind it up here. Christian, I wanted to know, find out, is there somewhere online that people can find your writing or, you know, keep up with what you're doing?
Well, it's very, very boring, but on academia.edu, I've uploaded all of my chapters and articles and book reviews and such. And that would be it. I'm at the moment digitizing the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, which was a WBAI radio program that featured Peter Lamborn Wilson. He had a show for like 12 years or something, and Bill Weinberg and Anne-Marie Hendrickson. So I'm digitizing that. So that will be ready. I'll put the link to that on my academia.edu site as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
thanks a lot for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure.
All right. For me, Eric, to all you out there, keep your minds open. Mm-hmm.